during the war.
Oh.
Just for the benefit of the tape, the chap we were looking for was
Jack Bridges. He was with the headquarters company as quartermaster and looked after all the stores. So.
Mm-hmm.
But he had everything accounted for. There wasn't a single discrepancy questioned. Everything just turned in, and that was the end of it.
Well, what was the officer's, your responsibility in demobilizing a company in the field?
Well, mainly to
ensure
account for the equipment that you'd been issued with, and, but they weren't very critical, of course, having won the war and so on. There weren't very many questions asked, and Zank's books were in perfect condition, so that, there was no problem whatever as far as our things were concerned.
Now, were you giving thoughts at all to getting out of the Army, or were you...
Not really. You see, I was within about 5 years of the pension when the war ended.
Mm.
And so I expected to, I would stay on. And then, in addition, I also expected that I would be required to drop back a rank or so in peacetime, but I wasn't. I had to stay on as lieutenant colonel. So,
well, how did they decide who would drop and who wouldn't? Was it a case of your permanent force, you would maintain it?
Well, some of them had to go back a rank, but not very many. They had, I guess, by the time we got home, they had an establishment approved. So many of each rank would be permitted to carry on, and so that most of us were able to fit into
the post
a job somewhere.
Did you remain in Europe after the unit was disbanded?
Well, no, I went to the reinforcement depot then.
Which was in England or France?
In England. And,
did you get a chance at all to travel across Europe or into Germany?
Well, I did while I was, but not after the war. I mean, then I just came straight back.
Mm-hmm.
But one disadvantage of being a permanent force was that even though I'd been over, I had more points than anybody else in the unit, I was required to stay on being permanent force because this was we're career soldiers, so we had to let everybody else go home, which was reasonable, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to this reinforcement unit, sitting there and waiting, and didn't seem to be anything for me to do, so I said, why the hell can't I go home if I...
You're just doing nothing?
Yeah, just doing nothing.
There were courses to go on, of course.
Well, not at that time. I wasn't even taking a course. So I went up to Army headquarters, and I knew one of the AG up there, who was an old friend of mine. I mentioned to him that, I was getting a bit browned off, sitting around doing nothing, and he said, what do you mean? Haven't you got anything to do? And I said, not a damn thing. And he reached for the phone. I just had time to get back to camp and get my kit together and get on the boat. And I was on the next shipment.
Back to Canada?
Mm-hmm.
To a job, or was it just to get out?
Well, landing leave, and my wife is in Vancouver, and I came straight through from Halifax to Vancouver by train, and I hadn't been there 2 weeks, I don't think, when I got a phone call that I was wanted at Vimy right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what for? Well, I was to be chief instructor at Vimy, and the present father, he's being posted out, and I have to hand over. And I said, God's sake, this is ridiculous. There's nothing urgent about this at this time. So I told the troop signal officer, I said, try and get me out of this. This is just silly.
It was a plum posting, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Vimy was a plum posting, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, so that part was all right, but...
the urgency wasn't necessary.
The urgency, yeah. Nothing urgent going on there at all. And, very relaxed. I just thought it was totally unreasonable to ask you, after being overseas for 5 years, to give up my vacation when I got home and go and report to the damn school.
I've heard other officers react to orders from headquarters. The kind of wording and the kind of message that's implied in, it's always immediately or
yeah.
Do it now,
right.
Instead of, okay, take your leave and be there at such and such a date now.
Well,
so how long did you get leave at, in Vancouver?
Oh, I guess a month.
Did you have any children at this time?
No.
How long had you been married at that point?
Well, we got married just after the war started.
Mm-hmm.
So I got married in September 39, and I went overseas in the following August.
So you'd only had about, what, 8 months?
Yeah.
Maybe 10 months.
And then I didn't see her again until I got back to Vancouver.
So in the life of a professional soldier, you went and marched off to Vimy.
I wasn't there very long. I went to Vimy and...
as what again?
As chief instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And then... I guess it was the following... This was just after Christmas. And then the following... spring, I was posted to Ottawa,
mm-hmm.
D.C.'s office, and I was there until 47, and then I went over to England on this course.
Tell me, had it been decided what sort of shape and form the post-war signals was going to take? Was it going to revert back to what it had been before the war?
Oh, no, it was much bigger than it was before the war. It was very, very small when the war started.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were well prepared for us, and
I guess we had someone like General Clark, for example, who had risen to such a prominent position.
Mm-hmm.
And was he director?
No. Winch was director when I got back.
Mm-hmm.
And. But
what was your job at Ottawa? I should ask you that. What were you doing?
Well, I was a G1 on the staff of the director of signals there. And we were just starting to get the post-war communication set up functioning. I remember one of the first, we were starting to work with the American signals, and we had our first standardization meeting. The U.S. Army officers came up to Ottawa, and we had our first standardization meeting. And
would this be with the British as well? Was it simply
yes, it was a tripartite arrangement, the British, American, and Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
And that started right after the war, or very, very promptly after the war ended.
Was Canada seen as an equal partner at that time?
Well, it was called the Tripartite Standardization Committee, but one of the American officers at that first meeting told me at the end of the meeting, he said, you know, we're all for standardization, providing it's on our equipment. And this has been their attitude ever since, you know.
Who can blame them? I mean, it would have been marvelous for them.
That's right. It's so really, we did a lot of important work in this field. but we didn't have very much influence on the Americans.
So I suppose if you had proposed a particular Canadian piece of equipment, that it wouldn't have been accepted by the Americans.
I can give you an excellent example of that. We had a... Well, this was after I had gone to the college and came back. At that time, I was posted to our research and development establishment at Ottawa. And this was a very good little unit. There's only about 150 people there, but it had a very good, capable group, and they were busy designing the new infantry pack set. And they came up with what was known as the CPRC-26, and it was a six-channel set, and all crystal control, crystal accuracy on every channel. And they had this set, and it met the specification. They worked on it for, I guess, a couple of years after I got there.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got it developed, and it passed all the tests, and they went through some very severe testing, such as dropping it in a parachute in a basket, and the damn parachute didn't open. Flew apart, and then put it together, and it worked.
Really?
Yeah. And we went on field trials with the Americans, and the American infantry, the American users, okayed this set and wanted it. And, you know, the Americans wouldn't give us final approval on the design of this set until they got their own set in production, which was a single-channel set, not even comparable with the one that we had, but theirs was called the Perk 6. And
same size, same weight, same...
But no, it was a little bit bigger, and...
It didn't have the capabilities.
It didn't have the capabilities at all. And they damn well blocked us until they got their own set into production, and then said, well, it's too late. We've got our own set in production. We can't adopt your set. Even though their own troops wanted it, had asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
The British took it. Holland took it. Australia took it. It was approved by NATO as the first approved infantry pack set after the end of the war.
But the Americans used their own set in NATO.
They used their own set.
Was that something that was repeated often?
Yes, far too often. I think this story was repeated with variations in relation to several pieces of equipment.
I do know this time they were trying to find some sort of standardized small arms.
Yes.
That went on year after year. The British finally decided on the FN, and the Americans wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, that was another example there. But, I don't know, it was... It did seem a shame to me that, you know, this is a set that was obviously better, and but you know, it wasn't. I don't think the people we were working with really were behind this. It was American industry, RCA.
Mm-hmm.
RCA had the contract to develop and produce this set, and they were damn well going to let it go.
Well, I would think that if the Americans decided to buy the or produce the set, it would be built in states, you know, under license,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that the industry would still get the benefit of it, but the profit wouldn't be there for the main company.
That's right, and I don't know how that part of it would have worked out. They certainly didn't give it a chance, anyway, to work out. But I guess you can't blame them. I mean, they're... But there's one thing I noticed in the American government, that industry has much more of a say than industry has here. Industry calls the tune on many things, and that take place in the U.S. government.
Well, I think it's because their industry is so much larger than ours, and...
Yeah. And so powerful, it is.
And it's all wrapped up politically as well as economically.
Yeah.
I think we should cut her off for today. I'm getting a bit tired myself. I hate to admit it, but the whole role of signalers and the equipment you use baffles me a little bit. I hope I don't give too much of it away, but... It's something I'm not technically oriented, you know, and the various equipment you use, the tasks, I think I understand, but it's still a bit beyond me. So a lot of the time I'm following what you're saying and perhaps not.
Well, I'm probably not explaining it very well to you. It's all very piecemeal, I know. I keep jumping around, but...
What's a technical service, though? I mean, it's not something that everyone can understand.
No, well, it's... You know, it's very much the same as exists in civil life, except that you have to be mobile and...
Wearing uniforms.
Wearing uniforms. But it's...
Let me ask you a very roundabout question, if I may, to end up on. Did you enjoy the war and the experiences that you had during the war? A lot of people say the war was the best period of their lives.
Yes, well, I certainly... I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but it was... It's just about the only time that a soldier gets a chance to really function as a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
In peacetime, you're always overridden by politicians, and everything you want to do has to be approved.
Budget limitations upon equipment and...
You can't move without somebody's approval in peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
In wartime, you're given a job to do, and it's... Given the equipment, and you do it. You've got to say about everything then. So that really, it's the only time a soldier gets an opportunity to really
apply
the
works.
And
it is an art. I mean, you apply it during peacetime. You're practicing to do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that from that point of view, it was most satisfying. No one was breathing down your neck saying you had to do it this way and you had to wait and get approval from this fella and so on.
You did it.
You
acted. Did you find subsequent postings and subsequent jobs to be tame afterwards and not quite as challenging because of the nature of it?
Well, I had quite an interesting career after the war in this research status, and I enjoyed that very much. It was very interesting work going on, and but there you did encounter this red tape galore and piddling little things, you know.
Whenever you're dealing with the public spending and public monies, you have to account to the bureaucrats for everything.
You count about 10 times over. For instance, we had to make up our estimate just of what we wanted for the next year, our plan for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd do this, and we'd ask for so much money, and usually they'd cut it back a bit, but finally they'd give us a budget for the next year. And then you try to award a contract to industry to do some job for you. And anything everything that amounted to $25,000 or more had to go to before the Treasury Board, before you could, even though they had approved your plan for the next year. Okay, you can go ahead and do this. Every time you wanted anything that cost more than $25,000, it had to go back to Treasury Board.
Mm-hmm.
And they would ask the same damn fool questions all over again every time.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they'd release it. And then next year you go up and try to get your program approved. Well, you didn't spend all your money last year. We didn't spend it because they wouldn't give it to us. they wouldn't allow us to. They held things up. And this would go on and on and on. In that sense, it was very frustrating trying to work within the civil service.
Did you ever get the feeling that perhaps people were doing this simply to justify their own position within the bureaucracy?
Yes, I think so. And there's a great tendency for empire building, you know. One of the silly things that was still going on when I left Ottawa, I don't know if it still exists or not, was that every telephone that was installed for the federal government anywhere in Canada had to be improved in Ottawa. So that
every single telephone?
Every single telephone. If you had an office in Vancouver and you wanted to add an extension, in your, you had to write to Ottawa to get approval for this. I don't know whether that still exists or not. I don't think it does now. But this was the sort of attitude. They were so afraid to let anything get out of their control.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess the fear is that money is going to be spent willy-nilly if they don't control it, but...
But you see, all they had to do was say, well, you're allowed so much for your communication system for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to stick by it.
Yeah.
But this never seems to occur to anyone. They don't trust you. So they'll say, well, no, you have to get our approval before you can spend this money.
Mm-hmm. Frustrating, wasn't it?
Oh, God. I remember when Diefenbaker first came in, he started chopping and chopping and chopping on expenses. And I didn't blame him for this, and I was quite willing to cooperate with him. And we were to reduce our travel expenses by, I think it was 10% or 15%
mm-hmm.
for the coming year. Well, even my own boss, one that I didn't respect too much, I'm afraid, he said, well, okay, we're going to cut back on travel this year. And so every trip you want to make, I want a detailed letter explaining why it's necessary, where you want to go, why you have to go and so on. He could have said to me, your budget's reduced by 15%.
Work within it.
Yeah. And work within it. And I would have been happy to have done this. But this maddening way of saying, well, every trip, and he didn't know whether the trip was necessary or not.
He didn't much care, probably.
No, he didn't. And so this is the sort of attitude that, oh, it used to burn me up in the government services.
It just wastes time and produces paper that's unnecessary.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll cut it off here if we can, sir. And would it be possible if I came back we could wrap up the your service career? And I'd like to talk about Ottawa if I could with you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind?
No, not at all.
Great, thank you. When did you leave the service? Probably about what year?
1959. I actually stopped working in September 59, and I was on leave for 6 months following that. And then I was out.
And what did you do upon retirement?
Well, I got a job with Montreal Engineering, I had no idea what I was going to do, and I started looking for a job. And, I decided to take this job in Montreal. I had another opportunity which perhaps you never know looking back whether it was right or wrong, but I had a nice offer from the University of Saskatchewan. The Dean of Medicine there wanted someone to be an assistant to him and to act as a liaison between his department and the electrical department on the design of medical equipment, electronic equipment, you know, used in medicine.
Had you been doing that kind of work in Ottawa at all?
No. This is what scared me a bit. I didn't think I was up to it, technically speaking. I'd been on administrative work for so long, I felt, you know, I wouldn't want to take on a job like that and not be able to carry it out to the satisfaction of the people. But, you know, I'm thinking back, I needn't have felt that way because I wasn't expected to do the design work. The engineering department would do that, the engineering faculty.
You were to be liaison.
I was to be liaison. Mm-hmm. It would have been a damn good job, I'm sure.
And a great challenge, too,
yeah.
I should think.
But I decided to go to Montreal Engineering. They both offered me exactly the same salary. Another reason I didn't, by this time I was 53 years old. I thought, well, I'd rather live in Montreal than Saskatoon. That was quite attractive. Because Saskatoon, it's a nice city, but it's a way off from the blue by itself, you know.
It can be a bit cold in the winter, too.
Yeah, and it can be pretty cold in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But it would have been a good job, I'm sure. I was out. The Dean of Medicine came down to Ottawa and interviewed me there, and then he invited me back out to see the university and show me what they had.
Well, you know, in a bit of a secret,